This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
My dad taught me a lot, including how easy it is to forget to cancel things. So I downloaded Experian, my BFF, big financial friend. Experian could help me cancel my unused subscriptions and lower my bills, saving me hundreds a year. Get started with the Experian app today. Your big financial friend's here to help you save smarter. Results will vary. Not all bills or subscriptions eligible. Savings not guaranteed. $631 a year. Average savings with 1+ negotiations and 1+ cancellations. Paid membership with connected payment account required. See Experian.com for details. Experian.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back. This is part two with Thomas Mills and I wanted to reach out and let everyone know I greatly appreciate you listening to this podcast. If you could, please go in and give a 5-star review and comment. Those really, really help me, motivate me, keep this podcast on the chart of interest for a lot of people that are hunters and outdoorsmen and those that want to change their property. So I thank you for that. Also, if you want to reach out and provide some topics, recommendations, I would actually like to have a few listeners on this podcast. So if you're willing to contribute and come on the podcast, I think that would be an interesting discussion. You can do free form, ask me questions. We've done that in the past with folks that have come to the Habitat Day. We had a podcast just on that. He just asked a bunch of questions and I answered those. But anything that you want to share, any new ideas or concepts, even though, you know, it's I've got my set of folks that are on this podcast, I'm open to having additional people come on the podcast so we can learn and grow. I want to have some more reoccurrence of the existing guests, but anybody you're interested in listening to or talking to would be greatly appreciated. And you can send those back to me in comments. You can email me that at john@whitetaillandscapes.com. I want to just hit quickly on one topic, You know, this is obviously part two, and some of the terminology we use may or may not be familiar with you all, but the term agroforestry comes up quite a bit. And that term really is intended to meld the term agricultural practices and forestry practice in together. So agriculture, which would be crop and pasture practices, and forestry would be the culmination of our woodlots and forest stands. So just think about that. And in that basic premise, we have like some basic fundamental goals. One is increasing diversity in the landscape. That means having a lot of layers of plants in that system. I'll just give a quick example. In riparian areas, a lot of times what we do is we try to have a soft edge or a wet plant, you know, right on the stream bank. One above that can handle flooding. And I'll just give some quick examples. Willows and buttonbush would be two examples right on the edge. Then we may have like a species like, you know, the ash, white ash, green ash. And then, you know, potentially in the Midwest, that would be like a pin oak, you know, just as an example that can handle some flooding. And then we would have an upper or taller tree species, you know, white oak, black cherry, something like that. Maybe some timber value like black walnut, although those other two as well. And then interior, that would be the other side of that, the bigger tree. You'd likely have, you know, some type of shrub. Now, it could be a wildlife shrub, you know, focused on, you know, some type of production value. It can be an edible shrub, you know, edible to deer, or it could just be a source of cover. And a lot of times these in-between areas are great travel corridors for deer, depending on the way you shape them, the size of them. And again, what we would add complexity to this layering system. But on the far end, meaning the edge interior, you would have a, you know, natural grass, and that could be switchgrass for that matter, a variety of different grasses, and then you would have your cropping practices. So that's an example of integrating a riparian area, some layering system, and then agriculture. And that would be kind of a good definition. And just a couple things is, you know, we want to increase plant diversity. I continue to say that, and this is that complexity in the landscape. And what that does is it integrates plants in order to form more of these neural networks between plants that increase the disease resistance and insect resistance because of the exchange of nutrients. And so that will attract a wide variety of positive and negative insects, predatory, non-predatory insects to a particular area. And of course, you're hoping to balance those without adding any of those fungicide, pesticides, those type of things that kill insects on our landscape, et cetera. So you're strengthening the ecosystem with adding diversity. And then the big thing is increasing productivity. So the trees themselves are producing better soils. At the end of the day, that's one of their objectives, and more of these fungal connections. And those better soils lead to better output, which could lead to better mass cropped, whether it's apple trees or, you know, crab apple trees or overstory trees like acorns that are, you know, oaks that are producing acorns on the landscape. So just think about that in context when you're kind of coming up with a plan. Again, this is part of the design philosophy where you're taking some of these concepts, applying them on your landscape, and you're gaining from them in shape and form to create corridors or movement cycles that are, you know, more well-connected. Better breeding opportunities as a result of the cover because the animals have, you know, more fitness. They're more able-bodied and more capable to reproduce. And those are things that kind of go hand in hand with having, you know, good seed stock or good sources of food, good sources of value, which create great attraction. All right, well, here's part two with me and Thomas. Thanks.
Yeah, as far as the understory trees go, my main understory trees in this area are going to be mulberry, pawpaw, persimmon. You know, some of those are going to get taller, but they can handle a little bit more shade. So it just kind of depends on, you know, the site. And sometimes they're going to do better, sometimes they're going to do worse. You know, again, a lot of that's based on survival rate of all the other trees around them too. But in addition to that, other soft mass trees, apples, pears, you know, those are going to require more sunlight for sure. And then not to overlook other trees that aren't, you know, the typical mass producing trees, but like service berries and things that are going to promote a lot more biodiversity, attract more birds, more beneficial insects, stuff like that. So I do a lot with like the service berries and viburnums, you know, all the way down to the shrub scale. So I think it's important to balance all that stuff out. And, you know, when it's all said and done, we want this nice brushy row that's really filled in. And that also helps take some of that pressure off those trees. If we have a tree out on an island by itself, it is almost 100% going to get rubbed on by a deer.
Yeah.
But if we have shrubs all around it, then it's much less likely for that to happen. You know, it's kind of the same concept that you employ where you have lower branches on those trees. Those bucks are a lot less likely to rub them all up. So if we just kind of protect it with those shrubs, it helps a lot.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to note on that before we move on to the willow stuff is I agree with you on, you know, the circular plantings or irregular shapes and stuff. And that is ideal. I like that in a lot of situations. The caveat there, especially with a couple of these plantings we've got going on this year, we're trying to set these up where cattle are going to be in that area. You know, it's either an existing pasture or there's a pasture adjacent to it. And we want to move those cattle out of that pasture into this wildlife area for a short period of time to help manage some of the invasive brush or, you know, cycle nutrients in our prairie plantings, whatever it might be. But by planting them with this method, essentially any one of those T-posts that holds that welded wire gets a electric fence insulator put on it, and then we just run one hot wire right down that row. And that the client planting that has the really poor sand, sandy soil, the beach sand type stuff, that property is, I'm really excited about that one because the pieces are really starting to get put together on that improvement side. And the goal or the plan right now is we're actually going to be moving this client's brother's beef cattle to the property this winter, and we're just going to bale graze those food plots. Because if we don't do something about the soil and get that biological activity increased, I mean, we can fix it with amendments, and we will, but the time and the cost to do so is exponentially greater than rolling out some crappy grassy hay and letting a dozen beef cattle consume that, lay in it, poop and pee in it, and kind of drive that organic matter into the soil and just load it up with microbes. So with that in mind, you know, we're trying to create these systems so it's easy to protect those trees, not just from deer, but also cattle, and keep them in rows that, you know, it's easy to maintain all that stuff around them.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the whole bale grazing or grazing with that integration is pretty important. The other thing that I'm focused on in a non-cattle environment, like, you know, with myself or clients, is being able to get equipment in there to add amendments easily, and thinking that relative spacing where I can get my big, you know, sprayer on the back of my tractor in an area, and I can just leaf out or spread out some of the amendments that I'm, you know, employing. Again, there's a cost prohibition related to that you have to be considerate of. But again, we just talked on one of the other podcasts, is just having molasses, just adding a simple form of molasses to the soil to speed up the microbial activity within the soil, like really simple additives, sea kelp, those type of additives that are nutrient beneficial as well as feeding the microbes. So just a simple concept there. Let's bump over to willows for a second. I know that you've put in some willows. In fact, I think this is what I really appreciate. We can build fencing out of willows. You can create all sorts of, you know, baskets. I mean, you can take all sorts of things out of willows, right? And we've typically used them as living fences here, right? They've been former living fence. They create great hedgerows. And I'm big on bringing back hedgerows. So advocating those. I was on a property a month ago. It was in Western New York, down in Steuben County. And I was really upset because they're taking out, and this is a really, we'll say, active farming property, and they're taking out every single hedgerow. And, you know, those travel corridors that they've been there for eons, you know, even directing bat movement. I mean, it's a form of corridor that connects properties that become, you know, very enhanced and well utilized by most animals and insects, including bats for that matter. And I just sat there and I said to him, I'm like, we're literally like, I feel like an eco-terrorist standing here next to you. And I could have that honest conversation with him. I'm like, why are we destroying these properties? I want to enhance these hedgerows. And again, part of this is thinking back more logically to slowing down wind on the landscape, you know, collecting mineral content in the air, you know, and placing more moisture in and around these hedgerows, and then enhancing them, you know, ecologically, so they're functioning, even to the point you were making earlier of having variation of plants that can handle overstory and understory species. So, you know, I was in this situation. I was like, man, this is like a willow candidate I've never seen before in my life. Yet, you know, they want these really kind of contained areas. And again, they don't want any debris or anything
limiting their ability to farm, you know, mass landscapes. And again, this is where we get into capitalism at its finest. So what have you been doing with willows? I mean, you can create protection barriers. I mean, even over, you can connect the top. So you have these like little tunnels you're traveling. Like, what are some things that you're thinking about that you've been doing with willows that I think maybe the audience might want to hear about?
Yeah. So kind of the same general concept. Well, actually both the conifer and the fruit tree plantings that we do, you know, the willows are, they're kind of that intermedium between the two, faster growing. That's obviously one of the major appeals to them, faster growing and, you know, more options really. Right. So one of the big plantings that I did recently was an access route planting in a very tricky location for the client to get in and out of. We've proved the efficacy of the stand location. He's killed his last two target bucks from the spot, but it's a low route. And by that, I mean the deer are bedding at a higher elevation than the access route. So they're basically looking right down on top of him. So a couple things that we've done already in this spot, we had to pull some permits from the Department of Natural Resources and the county to fix. There's an old kind of eroded, runoff or like a ditch area that paralleled a spring. So we had to pull permits and we fixed that up, utilized that to create a little bit better berm and better access route, but it still wasn't enough. So what we've done is lined both sides of that access route now with a single row of willows at 2 foot spacing. And it's kind of twofold. The first thing going on there, you know, from the client's perspective, the first priority there is screening the access route. My priority was stabilizing that erosion along that stream bank or that where that spring and that drainage was. But, you know, again, both positives. So we're creating living fence on both sides of that access route because the deer also like to cut through this spot in many, many locations, and we want to avoid that. So we can control where and how those deer are moving through the area, and then we're screening off our access. But because it sits so low and also it's on the south side of this food plot, or we're kind of, if you can visualize this food plot, it runs, it's long, it's about an acre and a half, it's broken up into a couple smaller plots, but it runs basically east-west, and this access route's on the south end of it. So if I just go plant these willows and they get 16, 20 feet tall, at some point in time, they're going to start shading out that plot on the south side of that plot, right? So with all that being said, and because I think it's going to be really cool, is our plan is once those willows reach a certain height, we're going to actually bend them over and kind of weave them together to create a tunnel there. So we're going to create a fence on the low end of that. And then on the high end, we're going to bend as much of that over as possible and create a tunnel of willows through there and then keep them, you know, somewhat trimmed so that they don't get super, super tall and shade out that food plot. So that's one of the main applications. Some other spots, actually one of the locations that we did the conifer screening, we actually put willows in front of that. Both those rows, the conifers and the willows, run north to south, so there's no competition for sun resources there. But the idea there is these willows are going to fill in significantly faster. And also it worked out really well because there was a wet spot and a dry spot. So the conifers went in the dry spot and the willows went in the wet spot. And actually that location where we put those hybrid willows in, there was actually quite a few native willows popping up too. So we left those there and gave them enough space. And then on the other side of this like kind of wetter ditch area, we put the hybrid willows in. So screening application there as well, not specifically for an access route, but screening off a roadway. And then trying to think of the other plantings that I've done with that recently. The other one was another food plot screen to block off a roadway that came through not too far away. That's kind of the bulk of what we're using them for, is the screening application. But, you know, one thing I wanted to mention real quick, you're talking about these hedgerows coming out. That's really the whole thing that inspired the concept of these orchard edges that I put in, is creating hedgerows, but with added food value to move deer across the landscape. And I saw the same thing. I mean, here in the Midwest, it used to be just tons and tons of small dairy farms all over the place. And then there's been this transition. I don't want to call it a progression and give it a positive connotation, but you know, there's been this transition from small fields and smaller properties to basically taking out anything that, you know, is an obstacle in the way of larger equipment. And with that is all those hedgerows and those fence rows that have come out. And man, it's really screwed up the hunting in our area, you know, and that's not even including the other ecological damage, like you're talking about, navigation for birds, nesting for birds, navigation for bats, all of that, you know. We're taking a fragmented landscape, but at least there's connected corridors, right? Mm-hmm. And now we've just removed all those connected corridors and it's just more fragmented. And that's what you're going to see typically across Iowa, Illinois, a lot of Ohio. You know, it's basically islands of timber here and there and not a whole lot connecting them. And that's just not good for wildlife. You know, it's going to reduce genetic diversity in any one of those areas. Going to, you know, essentially put populations on islands. And yeah, I don't like it. So the orchard edge is kind of the same concept. You know, you can use it as a buffer for screening. You know, I really like the orchard edges for screening the side of a food plot that deer are coming from. So, you know, we have the human side of a plot a lot of times and the deer side of the plot. The human side is where we access from and exit from. And that's really great for things like the willows or conifers or switchgrass, something that's not super attractive to deer. And then on the other side of the plot, putting in, you know, the system of trees and shrubs and letting it get brushy to create good screening cover. So those deer can't really see in the plot real well, but they like to hang out on the backside of that or move along that edge in the plot and communicate with, you know, a series of scrapes and all the things that come with that. But also has, again, that food abundance. So you can employ those in a lot of situations. And actually this client property that we're doing, the Willow Archway, if we want to call it that project, that tunnel, the Willow Tunnel, there's actually some old hedgerows on there that I was looking at yesterday when I was on the property. And I think I actually want to tear them out and replant them in a different direction because things have changed so much in that area now. Where these hedgerows run right now, they're directing deer into an area where deer don't really want to be, down into this open bottom right towards a pretty well-traveled highway. And they're isolating the pasture from current cropland, but this client wants to get rid of that cropland and put it back in wildlife habitat. So my thought actually the other day, I was looking at it from the opposite side of the property. This is all bluff country. So you know, I'm on one hill looking across the valley. And I was just kind of thinking like, well, maybe we should just take it out. You know, it's all low quality trees in there anyway. It's mostly box elder and cherry stuff, you know, faster growing trees. I don't want to say low quality. They all have some quality or benefit to wildlife. But I was thinking about taking that out and basically putting a new row in that traverses with the contour and gets the deer to flow into these areas where we're trying to get more deer movement versus, you know, basically a perpendicular cross section of their travel patterns or their, you know, travel corridor. So there's a lot of options there, but deer are edge animals. They're an edge species. And actually this, you know, while we're on that topic, this particular property, I think I told you this story once, I don't know if I shared it on the podcast, but this client is he's a great client. You know, he understands a lot of this stuff more now than he did 3 years ago when we started working together, but he asked a lot of really good questions. And last fall, because I tagged out basically opening weekend of bow season, he wanted to set up a time and talk about hunting strategy going into the season for him. He doesn't usually start hunting until late October. And I said, let's just jump in a blind on your property and we can kind of, you know, look at the situation firsthand. I can point some things out. We can talk about hunting strategy and our plans for habitat improvement during the off season or the up and coming off season. And the reason I bring this up is because as we're sitting in one of these box blinds looking across the valley, he asked me, he said, why did you plant those trees and shrubs in that row like that that came off the hillside? And he's like, I always thought it was better to plant them in blocks or like in, or not blocks, but like clumps, right? And you know, I kind of explained to him the things that we just have been talking about. And I like clumps, you know, clump yeah. here, clump there, it's yeah. great. But in this particular situation, I said, I'm trying to create an edge. We're trying to get an edge to move deer from basically from this area of cover down to this food plot, which is fairly secluded, but there's a stretch of grassy prairie habitat in there. So, you know, less cover essentially. And I kind of explained to him the same thing, you know, deer are edge species. They love to follow a line like that. If you can create a nice edge with cover, especially add some food value in there, deer will flow right down it. But realistically, you can draw a line across the topography with cover and deer are going to flow along that line. And I no sooner said that to him, and I could see, you know, in his mind, it was kind of, or in his eyes, I could see that in his mind, he was like, oh, I think I kind of understand it, but I also think that maybe you're kind of full of shit because I haven't seen that firsthand. And it was just, it was perfect because within 15 seconds of me explaining that to him and me like kind of seeing that look in his eyes, four does popped out of that woodlot on the other side of that valley and literally walked right along that edge, straight down to that food plot, putting them 15 yards in front of that box blind that was in that food plot.
Eureka.
And he's like, yep. Oh, I get it now. And it's funny because as he was helping plant those conifers the other day with the tree, the tractor three-point planter, and he had a friend out there that he was showing around who was going to be turkey hunting there this weekend. And that guy was, I don't know the guy, and I don't want to talk ill of him, but my 10 minutes of exposure to him, he was very pessimistic and, you know, he didn't want to believe anything. And I heard him kind of ranting about this and that and this person and that person and all sorts of stuff. And he was complaining about deer and, you know, people have too big of food plots or they can't do this or they can't do that. You never get a deer to do that. You can't kill a deer here with a bow. That's only a gun spot. And I just looked at him and I was like, well, we haven't really seemed to have any problems with that in this situation. And then I let the client kind of fill in the blanks and explain to him what we're doing and why we're doing it. And he told him the whole story about sitting in the box blind and seeing the deer come down off that hill and this and that. So it worked out really well. But that's, again, long way of saying edge habitat, super important. I think it's just really easy and straightforward. You know, whether your goal is to screen an area off and create movement along that edge, which is, you know, nice when you have a fence, whether it's a living fence with a willow or another reason why I'm planting these orchard edges in these blocks like this is because we're kind of training the deer to follow that edge versus, you know, popping through it in all these spots. And then we can also dictate, you know, where do we want them to move through it? If yeah. we do, you know, a bunch of short blocks or longer blocks, whatever, but having that edge, you can really get deer to move. You can really get deer to flow through areas. And then again, if your goal is screening or food or all the above, you've got a lot of options.
Yeah. And I think there's a couple of things here to add on to that. We'll probably break this up into two parts now that we're having this longer conversation is if you're thinking about the importance of hedgerows and then applying that concept, you know, to a hunting property per se is travel corridors in any sense, right? They're creating movement from A to B. And I always, when I talk to clients, I'm always saying, okay, it's a dumbbell, right? And we're focusing on the in-between portions connecting these two, we'll say other anchors or one side of the dumbbell versus the other side of the dumbbell together. And everything has to have this, you know, connection point. Well, you can shape those any way. They could have higher food value, lower food value, higher cover value, lower cover value. And so you're just pulling those levers each along the way. You can speed up movement. You can make them hunting situations where you almost have, you know, shooting through, or we'll just say, what's the right word? You know, shooting lanes into these particular areas, giving you, you know, your ability to highlight their travel as they transition across those corridors. And that's that open closed block system that you were kind of mentioning. But, you know, I noticed this years ago, and this is the first time I did this. So this is in 2002. Okay. So in 2002, I was, how old was I? 20. So I was 20. So 20, 23 years ago, thereabouts. You know, I was kind of working on this idea. Again, this is in the infinite stages of seeing people starting to take out hedgerows, the infant stage of them doing that. And I said to myself, my gosh, this is just, it's killing our connection to all these properties. And I said, well, why don't we texture this where there's lower overstory trees. We're going to cut those trees down and we're just going to keep the hedgerows here, but we're just going to let trees develop. And this is a similar process to you may have heard about this in the UK. Anybody who follows, you know, their kind of focus of designs, they've got a lot of sheep and, you know, different type of arrangements and patterns, but a lot of it was for land segregation, but they had this whole hedging system where they would put in hazel and they would cut it and they would form these, you know, living hedges, which again became marketplaces for, you know, birds. And just that was very critical on their landscape. And they saw that. Well, let's make them a little more complex. Let's have these kind of neat organized. And so we would organize the tops. So you would have the tops flowing in a certain way. They would create protection and cover. And that's generally what would end up, you know, just occurring is the fact that we would have crab apples or apple trees growing up in those sections, like just as a result of removing the overstory trees, because those were natural places where deer couldn't browse. And then there were rock piles. And, you know, generally you're dealing with a lot of woodchucks in those particular areas. So it created great hunting opportunities because that was a big, you know, staple thing in my days. They'd have woodchuck hunting contests. And, you know, I got to, you know, really kind of just enjoy that part of my life when I was younger. But again, it was just changing the hedgerow composition. And then now I'm like, let's shape the hedgerows, to your point. Let's make sure they're directionally functional so they make sense to general movement. Let's make sure that we're capitalizing within the hedgerow of different plants or species that are going to be mutually beneficial. Let's make the hedgerows more huntable, for that example. And a good example, my father and his friend, and we're doing deer drives. And this is a big part of my, you know, upbringing, is we'd go do deer drives, maybe the first or second week of gun season, probably usually the second week. And this is shotgun in this particular area, so there's no rifles. And we push these hedgerows. Well, we're amazed at how many deer we would kick up in a hedgerow. And again, very little cover, completely denuded of, like, you know, like you see in these riparian areas where they're starting to buffer and create more zones and things like that. None of that stuff, right? Just the hedgerow. And the amount of deer we'd kill on those would be incredible. They wouldn't hang out in the woodlots because that's where all the pressure was. Well, where would they go? They go to the hedgerow because they know that nobody in the right mind would walk a hedgerow, you know, a quarter mile or half a mile and then push it down one way or the other. Of course, those are the things that you learned. And so I'm like, wow, we've got to really kind of make these more functional. And I think the point I'm trying to make is, you know, every feature in the landscape can gain in complexity. And we've used this term quite a bit, is how do we increase complexity in your landscape? Whether it's, you know, creating irregular edges, adding softer tones to it, creating diversity within the hedgerow specifically, adding, you know, wood mulch as an example, just again, adding moisture retention, anything that will create variability. And just seeing the value of that will be significant. And don't use, you know, high value, don't use herbicides, don't use fungicides, don't use any of those sides that are going to denude or degrade the landscape. And I think that related well to the conversation I had with Matt on a prior podcast that we had. So just thinking more intelligently about every aspect of these particular designs and making sure the flow and movement is coinciding precisely with what is beneficial to the animal. And coincidentally, that could relate well to, you know, a hunting opportunity. And I think it's putting those two things together, you know, in at least my lineage. And now even trying to think more intelligent, you're talking about animal integration and grazing in these systems and being more mindful of, you know, how we integrate animals intelligently. And I think that's, you know, the silver pasture. In our case, we're doing a lot of agroforestry and some of these landscape designs, combining those two in some capacity. It just really kind of flows really well. I see these concepts make so much sense to me. And again, nobody in the industry really talks about any of these things because I don't know, they're not familiar, right? It's not within their realm of experience. So I don't know.
Well, they're not as profitable on the back end side. That's my personal take on it, right? Sure. It's like, that's where food plots are. There's such a marketable, easy, straightforward thing, right? You don't have to understand the complexities of the soil food web to sell a food plot seed. And I think that's where people miss out a lot. You know, and this, the sandy soil client is a good example of that. Really, really good clients, really receptive to learning and wanting to understand more. And this is typical of a lot of my clients. You know, you go in there and they're just focused on, what can I do to kill a big buck? Where should I put food plots? What should I plant? I'm like, well, you know, this is a system that you can improve over time. And, you know, with that is the amount of time you have available. Most of my clients are prominent, busy businessmen. And I try and get them to understand, you know, these perennial type systems that we've been talking about, whether it's screening or these fruit tree forest type systems, you know, once they're established, there's pretty much no maintenance to them. You know, very little maintenance And that's kind of subjective too. Like, you can put a lot more time and maintenance into them if you want them to be that much better, but you could also just kind of let them do their thing after they're established, and you're going to have some losses and, you know, so on and so forth. But getting them to understand that there's so much more out there that can make your property so much better. And with these orchard edges, creating this system of orchard edges and food plot system, you know, you kind of create this like Amazon jungle of abundance, right? Where you have really, really consistent perennial food. And that's about as good as it gets when it comes to attracting mature bucks. You know, if you have an area or a system on your property that's continuously producing food pretty much year round with minimal human intrusion, you know, you're not in there all the time. Again, first few years, a lot higher level of maintenance. But if you have a system that's producing nuts and soft mass on top of the food plots in these areas year in and year out, that's just setting those bucks up for success, right? They don't have to travel very far. They know where the consistent food is. And obviously it's holding a ton of does in the area. So all of the things that they need and want are in one spot, and the less you're in there, the better. And just, it just creates a really good system down the road. But it's a lot harder to explain that concept to someone than it is to say, you know, this magic bean is going to solve all your problems. Put this in the ground and go, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's funny because everyone has their own particularities, and it's your job and my job to identify those, whether it's sandy soils, how do we amend those? Do we add biochar? You know, are we adding nitrogen fixing plants in those particular areas to, you know, change the fertility quality? How do we build organic material? It's like, okay, let's focus on the fundamentals. And then let's fix any of the areas that are toxic or not uniform to what we're trying to create. And then my biggest thing is, how do we blow out the concepts that are just false, right? These fallacies that are created. And I think you've got these different hunting, or we'll say consulting celebrities that are out there, you know, promoting ideas and concepts that are extremely myopic because they think their audience isn't intelligent enough to understand, you know, potentially what they're trying to explain. And so, you know, and that's one way to look at it. In my ideology, it's like, okay, let's explain what's working. Let's explain what's not working. Let's create these functions or features on the landscape that characterize what normally would be present. Let's enhance those for abundance. You use that term quite a bit. And let's interface or integrate features that create high attraction levels for deer, right? That's kind of like a mission statement, I would say, for our businesses. So beyond that, there's all these additives. And the question is, how do I do it cheap, fast? And usually, and I've said this before many times, usually there's this trade-off approach. And most of the time it's too expensive. So what are the options that I can do, you know, do with what I want to get it functioning properly? And sometimes like putting in good road systems, infrastructure may be more beneficial than worrying about the next plant that you have, because you got to get into areas and work. And then if you buy a property that doesn't have, you know, a degraded landscape, and one example was having a lot of plants that are not necessarily native and are extremely noxious. Privet's one of those examples of property that I was on recently, just covered in privet. And I'm thinking to myself, oh goodness, I mean, we're letting everything go to seed and it's just, you know, it's polluting the entire landscape. And it's, again, you know, denuding the biodiversity. And so it's like, okay, how do we fix all these levers? And it's really not adding the miscanthus. It's not adding switchgrass. Like, those are like monocrops, right? And so it's like, what are the plants that we can add that, again, have ecological services that are complex enough? And you're just, you hit on this earlier, is thinking about everything in layers and systems. And again, permaculture concept applies really well to our landscape design and features. But again, we always typically start with the soil. You know, I always go back to that, is you're only fixed based on the nutrients that are available and the geology that's present and the biological activity that's happening in your soils. And then beyond that is, okay, how do I add or additives within that to fix that system? How do I increase the functionality of the landscape, whereas I'm adding different plants at the right times and I'm getting, again, all this movement and flow to make it more productive? And then some of the concepts of mitigating, you know, hunting pressure, as well as changing kind of the cultural norms of what has been behaviorally problematic. So I want the deer walking on the property in a low stress environment, being able to navigate as I control and creating these environments that are just so conducive to just interest and movement that the predictability and the huntability goes through the roof. And I know that sounds a little bit abstract, but like, I don't know if you could collectively put what I just said together in 5 minutes, like that's our job. And I just don't think it's the bug in the jug. It's this one tree planting or this one option. It's like, okay, how do we build these complex environments? So I went on a rant a little bit, but I want people to start thinking that way, because every time I just got a client that just sent me a note and said, hey, I want to have pawpaw in this, like, I love this guy. I want pawpaw in this example under this overstory tree. Should I get grafted or a seedling variety? And I'm like, well, let's look at the mother plant and let's look how they manage. Let's look at their quality before we make a decision, because, again, seedling's going to have some variation in it, where we know a graft is going to be a little bit more pertinent. Now, people could argue one's more respectable on the landscape than the other based on, seed selection, genetic variety, et cetera. And I would argue that having a little bit of both isn't a bad thing either. And there's a cost usually trade-off with one versus the other. But you and I are putting honey locusts now in the landscape. And if you asked me 5 years ago, would I be doing that? I would say yes, because I was. But did I have the concepts and knowledge that I have today? And then you're integrating grazing animals into the whole system? Like, holy crap. I mean, that's so advanced compared to most people. So
my rant. And you're spot on. No, it was a good rant. I mean, you're spot on. And it's not to throw the sales pitch towards what we do specifically, but I think it's important to address that, because in this day and age where we all have unlimited access to information, right? We can Google anything. I probably told you about this potential or prospective client that I had a few weeks ago, didn't actually become a client. I suggested that we started with a virtual consultation. He came back with, well, I just punched all these things into Grok, the AI platform, and it wrote me a plan. Like, good luck with that, right? It's the same with YouTube. You've got a whole generation of outdoorsmen that have a YouTube education. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it's good overall. You can watch a lot of videos on YouTube, and the person that put together that video might be 100% accurate with all the information that he shares, but it doesn't mean that it's applicable to your situation. So if he's providing you with information, or if you're receiving information that isn't applicable to your situation, then it is the wrong information, plain and simple, right? Yeah. So our job as consultants, is to assess the situation and prescribe what we feel is the best route forward to improve the situation based on the goals of the client. And there's a lot of different ways to do it. And what I've learned over the years, to kind of circle back on the food plot thing, that's the hunting world. If I'm dealing with someone in the backyard landscaping world, there's other things that come up. What the client wants isn't always the best choice, and it's our job to explain to them the pros and cons of every situation, whether it's the eco rating, how much it's going to impact the ecology in the area, or the maintenance level involved with that, or the cost and the time. And the two of those are synonymous. But there's a lot of different examples out there. But yes, at the end of the day, our job is to, first and foremost, see the potential of any property. And then secondly, help them identify what it's going to actually take to get there. And there's multiple ways to do it, for sure.
Yep.
But, there's a lot of ways that just aren't sustainable. That kind of goes back to the trending, consultants out there. A lot of the stuff that they're preaching are short term. And that might be okay in some situations, but, if you're putting a Band-Aid on a situation, then you're not really fixing the problem. So it might provide short-term benefits or results, but at some point you're going to have to come back around and address the problem, face the root cause or the root of the problem itself to have a more sustainable system or situation. And that's where I think all this stuff really comes together and is important. Again, back to the client with the sandy soil and the animal integration there, the conversation I had with him, he grew up in a farming family. He's not new to the food plot and farming side of things, but his whole life has been take a soil sample to a local co-op, have that agronomist make recommendations, and they want to plant corn in a bad way in this spot. We're in northeastern Iowa, and those guys love their corn. And, I just told him straight up, I said, you can put in all this synthetic fertilizer that the co-op recommended and you know, probably push a average yield, or you can be thinking about the biology in the soil, you know, because the synthetics are going to burn out what little biology is there. So you can think about the biology of the soil and building that soil over time. And, you know, we can use more ecologically or soil friendly fertilizers. We're not going to get as high a yield the first couple of years. You're still going to have decent yield. You know, it's not to say that you can't produce with that, but we need to be thinking long term. If we take the steps, including the animal integration, and we improve the soil the right way while we're putting in these tree rows, while we're slowing the water down on the landscape in this situation, we're going to build this system over the next few years that sets you up for success long, long into the future. And there's two people that own this property together. They both have young kids. And I always ask clients right out of the gate, is this a legacy property or is this just like a project for you, right? And when they have kids and it's a legacy property, I always try to get them to think long-term and short-term. And we pull it all together, right? Where's that balance? What can we do now? What are the low-hanging fruits? But also, how can we put together this plan and this healthy routine to build out these systems that have less and less inputs as time goes on and set up your children for success on this property as well, whether it's the deer hunting side of things or, you know, again, another benefit of fruit tree plantings across the property, not just for deer, your family can also benefit from those as well. Yeah. So, especially when, you know, again, the abundance thing, maximum abundance, and, you know, having apple trees, for example, that drop or have ripe apples late August, early September, you can get in there and you can pick that for your family and then leave the excess for the deer. And by the time hunting season rolls around, you just stay out of there and you let the wildlife have all of it or not. Or you go in there a couple of days and you pick more of them. You know, it just depends on the situation, but ultimately you got to be thinking big picture.
Yeah. And I think you have to fill the lowest holes in the bucket. I like that you're, it's funny. We never talked about that. Probably the second question I ask clients was, is this a legacy? Is it long-term? And thinking through their thought process around what the solutions will be, because there's going to be short-term, long-term. All right, well, let's have some long-term and let's have some short-term, because again, people want that return on investment. I had a client the other day and I wasn't frustrated with this client at all, but it's about expediency and speed is everything. And I struggle with the philosophy around that. I said, okay, well, it took 20 days to get my soil sample. Okay, that's fine. It took 20 days to get your soil sample. I'm here. I need to do something. I'm like, okay, go cut timber. And well, that's not good enough because it feels warm and we need to put food plots in. Well, let's take a look at your soil sample. And by the way, I'm just getting off another job, so I'm already tired, right? And I'm looking at his soil sample and I said, man, the biology, it just sucks. And that's been in a farm crop rotation for eons, just completely destroyed. Phosphorus levels are through the roof. Potassium is down tremendously. Guess what? Calcium is down. pH is super low. What do they have? Mare's tail. All over the place. And guess what? It's gone to seed. You can see it all over the place. And so I always fight crops with crops. That's been my goal. That's how I, you know, fast germinating crops that can remediate or take over or again, just launch out of the ground and try to upseat these other, you know, particular plants. I said, but you haven't addressed the biology or the chemical, the lack of, you know, the chemical composition issue. And so we go back to overapply to herbicides. You know, it's denuded soil. We have no organic material. You're kind of starting at like the ground floor. It's like, okay, your CEC is low, your organics are low, your chemistry is all out of whack, and you're worried about the seed that you're planting right now for the future. And I just wanted to shake the client and say, stop, stop. You know, what are you thinking? And it's this, I have to have an outcome. I have to have something at the end of this in order for me to get something out of this. And it's like, you got to remediate the soil before you start planting. The ideal, I guess, complex, you know, seed mix you want to add into this particular area. Well, and usually those seed mixes are like a pre-described brand, like Domain or whatever. And I'm not saying those are good or bad. I'm just saying, you know, they're just taking something off the shelf and applying it on landscape. So I bring that up as a topic. And, you know, these different mindsets are, I need something quick and dirty, or I need something long-term. Well, why don't you just remedy the soil at this point? Why don't you just focus on what you need? And really, like, I tell every single client this. You get your soil sample. Look at your pH. And I started out in my intro in this podcast saying, hey, look at your pH. Start there. Just remedy the pH. If that's one thing you can do, focus there. You know, get the right variation of limestone that would work in your soils and apply it at the proper rate. My clients have a whole, you know, basically methodology on what to apply based on soil type, et cetera. And then look at your soil in the next couple of years and build organic material. That has been my key to success on every single property that I've worked on. And once you get to that point, then you put in the sprinkles of increasing the boron or molybdenum levels or any of those type of other chemistry examples. And then you build the complexity to the soils with the seed choices. And then you have these ultimate kind of concoctions that create high level attraction. And then I'm finally at the point in my own property after many, many moons here, you know, 7, 8 years later, where I'm getting, you know, higher Brix levels and higher attractive deer in these high attractivity in these certain areas. And so it's working, right? I'm like, oh, I'm seeing the fruits of my labor, but it takes 7, 8, 10 years to get that to that point. And we only have so many growing days. And now I can speed up the process. I know, you know, what C4 plants to use, how to build the ecology around those. You know, we call it landscape canvassing and making sure that they're photosynthesizing at a higher rate based on seed selection and choices and how you do your layouts. Like, okay, I've gained all that. But if you start at the ground floor of like bad soil, you're kind of in a bad situation. I'm sorry to be really specific, but that's a topic that came up this week with a client. And I just really want to get them back to the origin of we're trying to build, you know, these environments where there's more water retention, better chemistry, better biology, and therefore better plants. And again, that just increases the overall just functionality of your kind of your landscape and its related design. And, you know, I think that's just something to keep in the back of your mind when you're getting into problem sets and figuring out what the lowest hole in the bucket is and what the problem set is that you're trying to solve and try to come up with a solution. And sometimes YouTube will help you with that. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes YouTube is too simple and too simple minded in order to get you the best outcome, if that makes sense.
Well, no, I mean, you're spot on. That's the beauty of conversations like this, right? These podcasts. Now, not saying we're going into all the specifics because it's really hard to do that in any conversation, right? That's where the one-on-one conversations with your client looking at the soil sample are the most effective at the end of the day, right? The YouTube world, the social media world in general, you know, it caters to the short-term attention span. And you just can't, you can't educate on something that, you know, it's relatively simple at the end of the day, but also very complex, right? You can't just explain it to someone with limited knowledge in 2 to 12 minutes. It doesn't matter. But when you have a specific scenario or an example firsthand, here's the application. You know, this is the scenario. This is the, like you said, the limiting factors, the lowest hole in the bucket. This is how we're going to fix it in this situation. And then you build out that timeline. And that's how I always look at it, right? It's okay. Year one, you need to do these things. Then year two, year three, you know, then we'll circle back. We'll pull another soil sample and see where things are. Obviously, you get a lot of good feedback, and there's a lot of things that you can, you know, you can observe without having to take a soil sample. I was just on a client property 2 days ago, and I was actually doing some willow plantings, some warranty replacement on a couple fruit trees that didn't survive. And then we actually, I had some extra trees with me, and he wanted me to put them in a different spot where he had already started his own fruit tree planting. So this is a good example, and this is no shade towards this particular client, but and maybe it's shortcomings on my part. Maybe I didn't explain certain concepts or certain theories to him. You know, in the last couple of years, he kind of went off the plan, went away from the biological approach, back to synthetics, all these things. And a lot of it, honestly, he told me straight up, he's like, I feel like I'm burnt out with the habitat side of things. And honestly, I don't feel like he put that much into it to begin with, but he felt like he was burnt out. He was kind of, and you know, he's a good client. I don't want to throw shade at him, but he kind of got sidetracked. You know, he got hung up on doing this planting or that planting, things that weren't even part of our plan. And yeah, he just kind of got burnt out on it. So I see that. But as I'm driving around the property, I haven't been on the property for a couple of years. I'm looking at these things he's got going on and just a couple examples of some failures that, you know, I actually am in the process of typing him an email to explain all these things to him. But couple of failures or potential failures that I saw. One very simple concept that a lot, I'm sure most of your listeners already understand, but it's just something so simple that can get overlooked. He went out and, you know, because we had pretty good success with the chestnuts and the apples and the pears that, you know, the orchard edge we put in on this property, he went out and he kind of decided he was going to start doing that on his own. And that's fine. But he basically had next to every stand location, he had a chestnut tree and an apple tree. And I called him on the phone and I was talking to him about this and that. And I, you know, I was asking him questions and then I kind of explained to him, I was like, you know, you don't have any other apple trees for like hundreds of yards around these apple trees. They need a pollinator pair, right? They need something to pollinate them. And the same with the chestnuts. Chestnuts are wind pollinated. So, you know, you need chestnuts as close to other chestnuts as possible, especially when they're young trees, because they're just not going to pollinate. So if you have trees like hundreds of yards apart, you're not going to get any pollination between those trees until they're pretty big and producing a lot of pollen. So that's kind of a simple fact there. And then another spot on his property, he had this food plot that he wants to break up with fruit trees. That as we drew out the plan, he's kind of altered a little bit, but he's completely skipping the first 3 years of the plan that were improving the soil before adding these things in there. And he's just been pumping the synthetics and focused on that, you know, single season production like you were talking about. And the soil is horrible. You know, it's a really, really heavy clay soil. And so I had a couple extra fruit trees with me and he's like, well, why don't you just go plant them in this row where I started this other row with a fruit tree and a chestnut. I was like, well, I can do that, but you know, we should probably think about fixing the soil here first. You know, so basically I went and planted these 1 year old grafted kefir pears that I had extra with me in clay pots. I mean, and I explained it to him. I was like, this is going to be a challenge for these trees to grow. There's just not a lot of air in the soil. You know, it's not that chocolate cake look at all. It's like literally a clay pot. When you start digging down into it, there's probably less than an inch of actual topsoil. And then you just get into like a really, really heavy clay. So that's going to fail. I mean, and I kind of told him outright, I'm like, I can do this. I can plant these and put them here, but it's not going to be good long-term if you don't do something about this. You know, you just keep on kind of ignoring the bigger picture again. So everything you said, I think is very important. And I agree with it wholeheartedly. You know, there's just so many different variables and ultimately I try to get clients to think again about that big picture, take a step back and think, you know, yes, what can I do right now? What is beneficial short term, but also what's something I can do this year that I might not see results for a year or two or five even, but yeah. Once I get to that point, oh, wow. And you know it, right? You know, when you hit that switch on a property, sometimes we don't see it because it's kind of that, you know, on the positive side, but you know, the frog in the pot of boiling water, like the change is happening so slowly that we don't really notice it until it hits us. But it's a positive, right? We're not killing the frog in the situation. We're saving the frog in the situation. And, you know, it's a lot of work and I can understand why guys can get burnt out, especially when you're a software engineer or something, right? That doesn't spend a lot of time playing with dirt. You know, it's easy to get burnt out on those physical projects, which is why you can hire people to do them if you really want to. But ultimately, it takes time to develop. It takes time to get these systems back to where they can function on their own at some level. We can always bring inputs in and amend them to get, again, more abundance and more productivity out of them. But just getting the biology turned back on these systems, providing the nutrients that they need to cycle through those systems, and getting it set up for long-term success is ultimately my goal. And, you know, sometimes the client understands that right away, and sometimes you can explain that to them, you know, for 8 hours straight as you walk in the property, but they're still just thinking like, where am I going to kill that buck this fall? What can I do to kill that buck this fall? You know, and that's just the nature of the beast, I guess.
Yeah. And I think it's, if you had a lot of success in your early years, potentially, or prior to, maybe you're not so worried about, you know, stacking another deer on the wall, that's potentially, or again, maybe everything drives that anyhow. So it's your individual mentality. One thing I'm going to mention, and this is just a concept I want to talk about quickly because this is my own personal property, the 18 acres from hell. And that 18 acres is maybe going to get harder depending on a few circumstances around me. But, you know, I've gone through the process of starting to remove, and I removed about an acre and a half of buckthorn so far. Went in there with a, you know, a skid steer and grapple on it, and then my tractor. And we're popping them out of the ground. We built this giant wall. And then what we did is I'm remediating the soil right now, and that's the whole process. And I'm going to do an acre at a time to 2 acres at a time every single year. And the focus is breaking the network of, so when certain plants come on the landscape, they denute this signaling that happens within the soil. And therefore what they do is they either produce a toxic chemical or they don't interrelate well with the native plants. And so, or what's naturally been on the landscape. And that plant becomes more widespread. So like the buckthorn takes over a thicket area and it's, you know, the predominant plant in the landscape. So essentially what I'm doing in these other areas is I'm creating more natural features that are going to, you know, create those original fungal connections. They're signaling within the ground. So let's like bring ourselves to the ground level. And so I'm changing the demographic of, and I'm using a bunch of different chemicals to do that. We'll say chemicals, positive chemicals. EM1 could be an example of a positive chemicals. We're creating more fungal connections within the soil. The net result is these plants, their survivability, the buckthorn specifically, goes down. And the seed sources that they've been plotting, you know, themselves to continue onward, because, you know, the females are producing a ton of seed, are going to continue for some period of time. Well, we have to fight plants with plants. That's the strategy, again, for the second time. And what I'm doing is I'm trying to denute the soil of that particular, chemical and chemical composition and signaling composition, and taking it out one section at a time and just being mindful of how to do that, doing it during the right time of year, removing the entire plant. I'm not cutting them and adding chemical to them. I don't want to do that on my landscape. And that's not being like, you know, righteous or having this dogma that you can't use chemicals. I'm not doing that. I don't want to do that. And so these are plants that can easily pop out of the ground if done at the right time. Again, you got to think a lot about your slope, the soil composition. I'm waiting to get my soil test back to see what the deficiencies are across the landscape, and remedying an acre at a time. And it's like, okay, I can do that on 18 acres. Well, what if I have 200 or 300 acres? It's like, wow, that's overwhelming. So again, you know, we work off the simple equation is start with the areas that are open that you know you can work on, and then start to remediate beyond that. And then, you know, take the simple cut of I'm gonna work on this area, you know, and then this area. It's the same thing with removing non-native plants. If you just jump in all at once and start removing everything, and it's a 20-acre property or a 100-acre property, it's just filled with plants that you don't prefer, you're gonna be overwhelmed. So the way I look at it is add the right plants at the right time, remove the wrong plants at the right time, and make sure you're remediating the soil so you have better, you know, quorum sensing amongst plants. And again, it's having the right communities of plants. And it's thinking about, same thing with when we're doing seed selection for our food plots. It's picking the plants that meet, you know, the certain needs. Plants that grow fast, you know, there's plants that grow slow. There are plants that have better, you know, fungal connections. There's plants that, you know, produce, you know, nitrogen, or they're fertility focused. So it's having the complexity of, I guess, services that they provide in a larger landscape setting that will be beneficial overall. And it's making sure, you know, movement and flow is correct. So again, animals are using them in a certain way, and animals are going to, I think you might've mentioned this earlier, but the whole grazing concept, animals are going to bring in fertility to the equation, and so are birds, right? So we need to think about, you know, what they're bringing to the table and their frequency. And then it's sitting there walking your property. I follow this one gentleman, I think you do as well. His name's Ethan, and he's got this great book. I think he was just on Mark Kenyon's podcast, and I just talked to him about coming on ours, is just thinking about the degradation of our landscapes, but listening to our landscapes and listening to the birds, listening to the just the activity around some of the plants, and just being more attuned with that and seeing the fruits of your labor, not worrying so much about the deer, you know, that you're trying to kill. And then focusing more on what does the deer provide us personally versus publicly. And that means not focusing on antlers, but focusing on the fruits of your labor, which is really the meat. And if you got right back down to it, that's kind of the mindset I think people should have before they focus on, you know, these great antlers. And, you know, again, the genetic selection piece of it that we mentioned last time of having, you know, not degenerative properties and degenerative traits. Matt and I talked about that, but having these, you know, I guess enhanced, you know, these regenerative type mindsets as well as populations of deer. So I think that's kind of a good way to kind of capitalize on what we're thinking. And I think this has been a mission portion of our podcast that we're talking through with you all, because I think I just want you all to buy into some of the remedies. And there's no recipe to all this. It's just, okay, where do we have failures on the landscape, and not us individually, but where does our landscape lack, and how do we plug those holes as well as remedy it to the sense that we get a better outcome? And that's really kind of all you're trying to achieve. And again, it's not applying calcium chloride or some of these other toxins we mentioned previously on the other podcast that I did a week or so ago. It's just being more mindful of kind of the nutrients you're using. I was working with a client today. He's like, I want to put nitrogen on the landscape. I'm like, okay, use these variations of nitrogen in your foliar applications at this time in the plants that you're planting. And he said, use them in a small quantity, you know, and again, we're minimizing the volume of nitrogen that he's added, because he wants added, and he's hell-bent set on doing it, and I'm not going to get him in a crop rotation that where he doesn't have to add nitrogen. He feels like he has to do it, and rightfully so. I think he'll reap the benefit of it, and I think that plant will reap the benefit of it, but it's not a necessity. It just isn't. But again, it's that feel-good thing that people need to explore, and it's the mindset that I can't fix, so I don't know. That's that's my thinking. Hey, did that echo to you at all?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Every situation is so different. You know, I think that's kind of the overall takeaway, is every situation is different. You know, it's kind of analogous to everything else that we see in the world. It's easy to look at that and be like, I want that. I want it right now. But how do you get there? And also, is that, you know, a realistic goal for your situation? So yeah, I get it. And if we can get more people to think that way, I think we're all better off.
Yeah. Sure. I'm going to have to figure out what to title this podcast. I'm going to break it up into two parts. You'll be listening here to the second part of the podcast, but you know, when I break it up, you know, there's a lot in here. I mean, we went from tree planting to mindset, and you know, it's an adventure. All this is an adventure. You know, I had a, I'm going to share this last thing, and I don't know if I even talked to you about this. So not this last trip, the trip before that, I was away for 5 days. I traveled a little bit, pretty quite far away from my house, and, you know, great client, and really appreciate him, stayed with his family, and I'll give him a shout out. Thanks, Tyler. I really appreciate you and your family. One thing I was going to mention was I was in an environment that was unique to my own, but not much different. And we were in a situation where we were cutting timber, and all of a sudden a storm came through, and we thought it was going to miss us, but it hit us like a freight train. And I created this, I'll call it a deer maze. You know, cutting timber, the form that I cut is very particular to holding deer in the landscape, right? That's, I can make deer bed in a specific location. Without question, I can make them move through the landscape. Without question, I can control every aspect of their movement pretty much. So I created this, we'll call it a deer maze. Well, this storm blows through, like, you know, hell's freezing over, and it's raining, trees are bending over sideways. And, you know, we're talking 50 to 70 foot trees that are, you know, bending off the ground. Like, you know, they're almost touching the ground, their tops, and treetops are flipping off. So we're in hell, basically. And I look at the client and I'm like, what are we doing here? You know, we got to get out of this. And we're running through this deer maze, and during the midst of trying to get out of there and watching, you know, daggers fall from these trees. And by the way, where he was standing, a treetop ripped off and landed in that location. Thank God we had just got out of there. I was thinking to myself, this level of commitment that I have to this property right now is very, very high. His success rate should be very, very good. I said, but man, I'm in it. And the mindset is I was willing to sacrifice and just make sure the property set up correctly at all cost. And I'm not saying me personally, he was right there next to me cutting with me. And we just wanted to get work done. And at all costs, we were getting as much work as we can done. We went home, storm blew over, went back out there and finished the job. And it's just that type of strength and focus, I think, is really important to everybody. I didn't die. Although I didn't put myself in the greatest situation, my commitment to that client and his commitment to the job was, I think, paramount. So, you know, you got to be committed to the outcome. And it's not always about, it's about going through the hard. That's all.
Yeah, well, and I just add one more layer to that. You know, those days definitely test you, and you do have to be committed, but you also have to be committed to get out of bed and go back out there you know, whenever it is, the next day to finish up, or a month later to follow up, or the year later, you know, whatever it might be. I think that's one of the bigger things, is we have this mindset a lot of times where it's like, well, we just got to get this done, got to get this done. And it's true. But I personally find this, you know, it's not the challenge of wanting to do it. It's more of the time where you're like, oh, I'm going to do that project. And then you kind of sometimes forget about the follow-up maintenance, or don't anticipate it the way you should, the time that goes with it. So I think that's all important. You know, being committed to it isn't just a one-time tough project, scary scenario. That is definitely a level of commitment, but also being committed to, you know, seeing it through down the road, whatever it takes.
Yeah. And I would just say to you, anybody who's listening to this specifically, is, you know, I waned here recently. I'm like, man, I'm working my tail off. I don't want to do a podcast, right? And this conversation right here kind of reinvigorates that. You got to understand, like, you know, you're running a business, right? And your time is limited. You know, you're coming on as obviously we're friends, but you're coming on to show your side of things and share. And it's a time commitment from all of us, but like, that's the commitment we want. We want people to be successful. And I kind of use this as a motivator to me to say, hey, keep doing this, keep providing the podcast. And, you know, it's tough. I mean, this type of year, these are my next three busiest months. You know, I have more clients in the summertime than any time of year. And I love working in the summertime, but it tests you. And certainly, you know, this is the thing that I focus on, is making sure that I'm consistent and showing up every day. And again, you know, I think you can do the same thing in your personal lives as well, in your properties, and don't give up and focus on some of the new ideas and concepts that are in this. You know, we've got to get more in the weeds, Milzna, like you and I got to get in the weeds for people, because I think the more we share, the more they learn. I hear people echoing what I'm doing now. I'm hearing other consultants, they listen to this podcast. They're saying the things that I'm saying. And that makes me feel good inside, because I know that people are listening to us, right? They're listening to the things that we suggest. And they're not saying it's their ideas. They're just identifying the same things we're identifying, because they realize that they've got to think outside the box. And you know, whether it's with cutting or approaching, you know, some of these situations with a different kind of vision, you know, it's just, I think people are kind of echoing some of the things we're doing. So that makes me feel good. It really does.
Yeah. Well, it should be good. I mean, talk about commitment and consistency, and you've done it, right? I mean, this podcast is a good example of that. Like you said, it's a commitment. It's a time commitment. You know, we're recording this on a Sunday morning right now, bright and early on a Sunday morning. because both of us don't have a lot of excess free time. And as I say that, my kids are poking me. The natives are growing restless. But I personally want to thank you for being committed to it, because you're consistently cranking out valuable information, a lot of good perspectives, a lot of good conversations that no one else is having in the outdoor hunting whitetail space. It's just not happening anywhere else. And I think these conversations are extremely important to have, just to open up other people's perspectives, or you know, shift their perspective, open up their eyes to other ways of doing things that are a lot more detailed and are a lot more sustainable in the long run.
And I appreciate your willingness to share, and everyone else that contributes to this are willing to share the plants, the techniques, the operational aspects of their business. And, you know, not everybody wants to play inside ball. We should do an inside ball. Yet the life and craziness of it, you know, somebody who's running a business in this particular world, like, this is not the world. If somebody, you know, people come to me all the time asking for careers and jobs in this. And I'm like, well, go make more money elsewhere. You'll make way more money doing something completely different than this. And you'll have such a better life, and you can focus on the things that you enjoy. And like, well, I'm this is my passion. Make your passion your personal passion. Making this other people's passions, you lose out on the opportunities that you may reap yourself, if that makes sense. So you got to be completely selfless. And so that's the mentality. You have to be selfless. So if you have any selfish attitude and any capacity, you're not built for this career. It's just not, it will not be helpful. And again, you got to be overly helpful, because you have many different perspectives you have to, I guess, dissuade it, that are potentially incorrect. So maybe there's a mindset shift there. And that could be some good lessons for some of the younger audience that are listening to this, that say, I want to get in this career field. I typically dissuade them, not from a competition standpoint, but from a, you know, what would be beneficial to you long-term, financially, perspectively, what fits your personality, what are you good at, right? Kind of exploring all those, you know, different attributes. And are you a leader? You have to be a leader and want to lead people, and you have to take criticism. And that's hard to do sometimes. I know that's hard for me at times. So, all right, man, let's try to end it here. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for spending your morning with me. And thanks for all the information you're willing to share. And we'll talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, John. Enjoy your day.
All right. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Right now, get up to 20% off select online storage solutions. Put heavy-duty HDX totes to good use, protecting what's important to you. The solid, impact-resistant design prevents cracking, and the clear base and sides make items easy to find, even when the totes are stacked. Find select online shelving and tote storage up to 20% off at the Home Depot to organize every room in your home, from your garage to your attic. Visit homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.